I've been doing news for 30 years in two languages around the world, and here in the United States, I've interviewed four presidents and co-founded a billion-dollar business. And I believe, after all of that, that news should be honest and direct and impactful. This is Direct Impact. So let's begin with this. Did you see what happened with President Biden? Alas, he met with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. Remember, this president, as well as most of his predecessors and the U.S. media as a coalition, has spent the better part of the last, six, 7 years making China and Xi out to be monsters. Then this happened.
Handshake, kind fist bump.
So is that an authentic truce? Probably not. In fact, before Xi's meeting, our government had chosen to freeze out the Chinese government, essentially treating it as if it doesn't even exist, as if its voice in Washington is not worthy of recognition. Now, is that a smart play? Or, as recently written by Politico, one that the Biden administration could live to regret? You see, usually governments, even if they don't get along, adhere to the agreed upon rules of international decorum by respecting each other's diplomatic corps, diplomatic representatives that they're sent to your country. At least you talk to them, right? You give them court. But when it comes to China, the Biden administration had chosen to abide by a different set of rules. Like Qin Gong, the China ambassador to the United States, he is one of the most powerful people in the Chinese government. But that gentleman, Mr. Gong, the ambassador, Mr. Biden decided that he and his upper echelon would not talk to him. They refused to meet with him. They refused to talk to him. In fact, since arriving in Washington, the ambassador from China, Qin, has been limited to a handful of meetings with low-ranking U.S. officials. The Chinese embassy has repeatedly asked for meetings with higher-ranking administration officials, but it's been repeatedly turned down again and again. And so we're left to ask the question, why? What gives? Why do you do that, right? Why would our government want to give the Chinese government the edge of seeming more conciliatory, more reasonable? Think or say what you want about the Chinese government. Think or say what you want about Xi Jinping, for example. But allow me to say this. Ignoring their ambassador, right, makes them look like victims. And it makes us in the United States look not so welcoming, maybe even bad, maybe even bullyish. And what does that say to the Chinese people, or for that matter, to the rest of the people in the global community? By the way, it's not just the United States government that's heavy-handed when it comes to China. In an increasing sign that our media is less than a watchdog, as it was once designed to be, and it is, as it has been in the past, it's become more of a cheerleader of our government officials when it comes to our foreign policy, especially our foreign policy. Look what happened recently when China held its National Congress gathering. Hu Jintao, 79 years old. He's frail, often appears like he's kind of out of it. I know, my mom is about that age, and she kind of looks the same way. Nonetheless, because he's the nation's former president, he was invited to the Congress. He seemed to have what some would describe as a bit of a senior moment during the Congress. But our Western media's conspiratorial coverage of the event made it seem as if for sure what took place was a plot. That's what they wrote. Maybe even a coup. That's what they wrote. Was it really?
And there was also an extraordinary scene at the closing of the Communist Party Congress. China's former leader, Mr. Xi's predecessor, Hu Jintao, seemingly forcibly escorted from the stage. Now, it looked like he was frail, that he wasn't feeling well, but quite obviously he didn't want to go. But Mr. Xi was sitting next to him, as were other top leaders, and it looked like Mr. Hu, in the end, had no choice. Now, this has become a topic of debate within China for those who have seen it.
Could it be possible that it was just maybe a disagreement? Maybe even a political power move between the Xi people and the Hu people? I don't know. And by the way, if that's the case, yeah. just like the type of thing that occurs in Congresses and in parliaments all over the world, probably on a daily basis, and gets a lot less coverage than that, and usually isn't called a coup or a conspiratorial play. So why do they overplay something like that? Why the extremely negative coverage? Why does it seem like our media is making a relentless effort to go beyond what is just normal critical analysis of China, which is well deserved, and more into a realm of hype and overplay, riddled with conjecture and coming to conclusions without the necessary facts? So let's talk about this. Joining me now is Saurabh Gupta. He's an expert on the geopolitics of U.S. and China relations. Saurabh, thanks so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
What is it with, especially at the beginning, where the Biden administration really was giving the cold shoulder to the Chinese ambassador? To what end do you do something like that?
The Biden administration has been craven in terms of engaging China, because U.S.-China relations were very bad during the Trump time. And the Democrats wanted to stabilize the relationship, but they did not have the political courage to go and do that immediately. So they did that in increments, a little bit, two steps forward, one step backwards.
But why? What would be the fear of reaching, even to your worst enemy, reach out to him, find out, hey, listen here, you, I got something to tell you, but I'm going to talk to you. You're not going to have meetings. This disengagement thing is what I'm really questioning first and foremost. It doesn't seem to win for anybody, and especially for you if you're the disengager, right?
Exactly. You want to tell them, go to them, tell them very clearly what your asks are, what your demands are, where you all stand in the relationship, and make it crystal clear. And the Biden administration has tried to get to that point, and it has done so very incrementally, and that's why it's been so wishy-washy, and you don't get credit at the end of the day for that. There has been progress, not enough progress, because the Biden administration is in two minds, whether we really want to stabilize this relationship or have some sort of stability while continuing to throw darts.
How do you think Xi perceives our president?
There's a difference between where the Chinese government perceives the administration and President Biden and where President Xi perceives President Biden. The reason for that being Mr. Xi is a tough man, but he has also a very long-standing relationship with Mr. Biden. And let me tell you the one thing which I think...
By the way? I didn't know that. How does he have a long-standing relationship with Mr. Biden?
First of all,
Vice President.
Yeah, as Vice President. Mr. Biden's been in politics for ages.
Okay.
Yes.
He has that.
Yeah. They were both vice presidents and during the Obama administration, and she was the incumbent president, going to be the president. So it was known he was going to be president, and so there was that relationship.
Interesting.
But I will tell you this, that in 2013, when she did become president, while Biden was vice president still, and Biden was traveling to Asia, it could have been very easy for Mr. Xi to say, oh, Obama runs the show, that Biden is just his clerk. What's the point of meeting him? We'll have a pro forma meeting.
Right.
But he engaged him for hours and hours on the substance of U.S.-China relations. He knew whether Biden becomes a president someday or not. But this is a man I can do, I have done business with, and it's important to create these connections at Washington at that level. They're thinking that far ahead. They don't know if he's going to become president, but they know he's an important interlocutor, and you need to engage him sincerely, and that's what they did.
So why can't Biden be more of a Nixon and engage and say, you know, I'm going to break the ice here and, you know, reach out, especially coming out of what was, in terms of China-U.S. relations, a disastrous 4 years with Mr. Trump?
That's a great question, and I'll tell you this. Last year, or was it this year? This year was the 50th anniversary of the Shanghai Communique, Nixon, Kissinger, and Mao in China, set up the foundations of that relationship. I'll also tell you, as I said, the Democrats are a little craven in terms of foreign policy engagement because the Republicans come at them and say, look at these people, and we need people. But I will say this, in the post-Cold War era, we've had three Democratic presidents, Clinton, Obama, and now Biden. Clinton, Obama, their first terms were pretty fraught with China. They couldn't step up and say, we want engagement. Of course, Clinton did push for MFN and get that done, the PNTR thing. But it was truly in the second term when he felt assured that they really had pretty good relations. Clinton, she Jiang Zemin in 1998, there was a debate at that time, are they a strategic partner, strategic competitor? Because the Republicans thought, hey, China can never be a strategic partner. With Obama also, the second term was very, very productive in U.S.-China relations. And so there's a potential, even in this new normal in U.S.-China post-2017, that if we do have Biden in a second term, if, that we may have a productive opportunity to really stabilize and ground those ties and make it peacefully coexistent. But I don't anticipate that happening now or for the next 2 years because domestic politics is going to override. And I said, the Democrats just don't have a backbone on this because they're fearful they will be
called commies.
Exactly. Or something on those lines.
It's like he talked to Xi, he must be a communist. We're seeing more and more military exercises off the coast of Taiwan. And these exercises, I would think, though basically uncovered by the U.S. media, they are covered in that part of the world. And it has to be scaring the hell out of the people, whether they're in, you know, the Philippines or Malaysia, even Australia. That rim is looking at what could look like the brinksmanship of war, whether we get to it or not. And the thinking, I would imagine, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, has to be that America may be pushing a little too hard there as well.
You know, America is pushing hard in the Indo-Pacific, and the real hit against the Americans in this regard has been that that there is a kind of a system, which is an inclusive system in the Indo-Pacific, and the U.S. is looking at wedges out there to create an us versus them situation, and is also in the process over-militarizing. And at the end of the day, I think this comes back to hurt America, because in Asia, Asia is still a part of the developing world. Most countries in Asia cherish development. China's main story to Asia is, let's grow together and develop together. Well, when America goes there, like Kamala Harris in APEC, has nothing to offer from an economic standpoint. She has only guns and military toys to offer, and they look out there and say, no, this is not what we are looking at. Yes, we cherish security, but we want to grow. We want prosperity. Prosperity will engender peace. What do you have in this regard? And there isn't an answer. Yeah. And that's why, because at the end of the day, even if you're going to compete with China in Asia, you will need a plurality of Asian states to back you. But when their main reason for their main primary purpose is to grow economically, they start asking questions. And these questions are now started to ask by people who are fairly pro-friendly, the Singaporeans and all.
Yeah.
They're coming down very clearly that whether Anglo-Americans, be it the Australians, the Brits, and the US are going, is not where they want to go. They say there are things like a digital trade agreement, like the CPTPP, the trade agreement, and they've been very forthright in saying, we want China in, while the Australians and the US are obviously out of it. It's like, no, China shouldn't be out there. Drawing these wedges is not going to be a very helpful strategy in Asia.
It almost seems, and your point's a good one, that you push too hard on guns, security, and you run the risk of turning your friends into enemies, because what they care about, just like what Americans care about, what you care about, what I care about, is the safety of my children and my grandchildren and my family moving forward. So when someone talks to me in terms that make me fear a war, I trust them a little less. Yeah. And I fear that we could be using that brinksmanship in the wrong way in those countries as well. So, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Sourabh. Thanks.
You most welcome.
Thanks so much for stopping by and having this chat. This is really important. This is an important conversation for all of us, no matter where we are in the world. By the way, I have a podcast where I, as a journalist, as a Latino, and as the co-founder of a billion-dollar company, tell my story and share with you what I've learned about how to succeed and how to grow. It's called the Rick Sanchez Podcast, and I invite you to check it out. Go there. I'll see you there. But when we come back, well, Russia says no more disinformation. If you report a lie, especially about our military, you could go to jail. Too much? Not enough? Just right? What Russia's doing? Let's talk about it.
Там пулевое на вылет.
Я делаю все для того, чтобы максимально обезопасить и довести их живыми.
Поехали. Уходим, уходим, уходим.
Я запереживала, конечно, что нас засекли, что именно били, потому что мы там ходили. Но ребята говорят, нет, слава богу, а то они бы ложили бы. Обошлось.
Орудие!
Выстрел!
В 2014 году автобус с горловскими беженцами расстреляли, сожгли. Там были мои дети, но они чудом выжили. Ну вот, ну, любой бы на моем месте пошел бы, наверное.
Тогда я помогу.
Да.
А стойте, стой. Давайте быстро.
Спасибо.
Маленький, иди сюда, сынок.
Огневую позицию занять.
Наводите.
По цели готов.
Поехали. Каждый раз получаю удовольствие, потому что с каждым моим выстрелом приближается время наших побед.
Конечно, страшно. Но я уже приняла решение. Я здесь. Бывает такое, что нервы сдают, хочется поплакать. Нельзя это показывать. Мне нужно, чтобы ребята шли в бой с настроением, с сильным духом. Да, я рискую жизнью, но у меня есть цель. Если мы это сейчас не закончим, будет хуже. Мы должны победить.
Museums are important for preserving our history so that it isn't lost to future generations. But are physical museum spaces themselves a relic of the past? This is one of the best museums in the world, the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. Mihail Petrovsky is the director here, and I bet he has some answers.
So Russia has updated its laws regarding fake news. Fake news, that's kind of a loaded word, right? That I personally never like to use because, well, I mean, unless I'm making a joke about it, right? Which is now what people do with that word. That's how they use it, as a joke. Because it's been so overused, it's kind of lost its meaning. It has come to mean much more than the meaning for which it was originally intended. Nonetheless, the international community and journalists, especially in the West, have reacted with such an aggressive stance. The BBC, for example, has recently stopped reporting on Russia. Why? Well, they're of the opinion that their reporters are now in danger for simply doing their jobs, right? Are they right? Is that really what Russia's saying? Is that really what Russia's doing when they say they don't want people putting out misinformation? Okay, first, let's look at this law that has been so reported on in the West. And let's look at it both in context and let's look at it as well in historics, okay? So in 2019, Russia passed this law establishing fines for publications of unreliable information, right? That's what it was. They didn't write fake news on there, by the way. Unreliable information. 2020, the laws were then expanded to include other unreliable information, especially when it came to COVID-19, because the government thought it was an important health matter and you shouldn't be lying about information when it comes to COVID-19 or putting out disinformation. And now in 2022, the laws have been expanded once again to include publishing false information about the Russian military, certainly in lieu of what's going on in Ukraine. And doing so could actually send you to prison for a number of years. That's why the BBC said, well, then we just can't cover this story, so we're going to pull our reporters. So forget all that, because there's always going to be a lot of mishmash with everything having to do with war and opinions about stories like these that are so heated. Here's the real question. And this really isn't so much about Russia as it is about what happens when a government has a right, or does it, to try and tamp down what is regarded as misinformation. Does a government have a right to deal with disinformation or misinformation? Remember, one government or one woman's misinformation is another man's truth. So this is where the wicket gets really sticky. So what do we do? What do we do? Not just in Russia, but what do we do with Twitter? What do we do with Facebook in the United States? That are making decisions about who gets in Who gets to share information? Who doesn't get to share information? This is a fascinating subject, not just because of the Russian law, but because of the situation all over the world. So, joining us now is somebody who certainly has a lot to say about this, because he's been looking at it and he's been writing about it. Ted Rall, who is a syndicated editorial cartoonist, a columnist, and an author. Ted, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I appreciate it.
So what do you make of this? I use Russia as an example. And, you know, they're going to have their reasons for wanting to have what many in the West call this fake news laws. But isn't this something that almost every government is going to have to be dealing with all over the world?
Well, every government always has to deal with messaging, positive and negative, no matter what. So the question is, how do they do it? And culturally and politically, every regime has its own way of doing this. The U.S. tends to try to do it through their connections to corporate media and to sell access to public officials. And they tend, you know, you can't really say that they call up the New York Times and tell them what to say and what not to say. But the influence is there. It's more subtle.
Russia says that if you're reporting on their country and you go there and make a what they would call a blatant lie, a blatant statement that is not true about their military, that that's harmful to their government, especially when they're in a state of war or military interventionism or whatever we're going to call our battles nowadays, no matter what country we come from. Do they have a right to do so?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, do they have the legal right? Certainly they have the legal right. You know, the question is, is it a good idea politically? You know, and it might be a good idea politically domestically, and it may or may not be such a good idea internationally, right? I mean, because they open themselves up to the criticism that they're censoring the news and they're trying to control the environment in a way that might not be acceptable to certain other Western countries, even though they try to do the same thing in a different way, right? So legal right? Absolutely. No question about that. And, you know, I mean, the United States, for example, has a long history of controlling the narrative and allowing, deciding, you know, which reporters get to get accreditation to be able to travel within a U.S.-controlled war zone. You know, if you went to Iraq as a CNN reporter and you said things that the Pentagon didn't like, they would yank your credentials and you'd be on your way home.
How could they do that? I mean, wouldn't CNN be responsible for assigning its reporters?
Well, CNN assigns the reporters, but the military would say, if you want our cooperation, if you want to be embedded, if you want us to care, if something bad is going to happen to you, it's like a protection racket. You know, we can't help what might happen there. And there's plenty of examples of that having occurred.
And the U.S. did that in Afghanistan and they did that in Iraq, for example.
Absolutely. Yeah, no question. I mean, I covered the war in Afghanistan in 2001. I was there several times since. You know, I was never embedded, partly for that reason. I think it's better to travel as an independent reporter and find out what's really going on the ground with local people. But that's my approach. And a lot of other reporters, corporate reporters, preferred to travel with the U.S. military. And if they didn't toe the line, they were kicked out.
It seems to me like there was a time when you and I were younger where there seemed to be rules that we all understood in terms of figuring out what was a story, what wasn't a story. I'm almost going to be as bold enough to say what kind of was the appreciated or conventional truths. And we had a media that we kind of trusted, even though you read back and you find out there was some hinky stuff going on. But at least there was a general description that we all kind of agreed on about what the truth was, what the world and our policies were, what our institutions stood for. Man, I gotta tell you, it just seems to me like that's completely gone today. It's gone, and I don't know in whose hands it resides. Do you?
Well, it's in no one's hands, and it's in everyone's hands at the same time. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot. It's a perfect storm. There's a lot of causes for this. You know, one thing is that everybody's discovered that opinionated news sells better than unopinionated news. It's also the fractionalization of the media, where, for example, in the U.S., there were three or four channels for news when I was growing up. And, you know, now you could get your news source from literally hundreds of internet sites and TV channels, including international ones. So, you know, I mean, I think it's everything's atomized, and there's a tendency for people to seek out sources that confirm their own biases and preferences.
Yep.
And not that that's necessarily bad. It's just human nature. But, you know, I think you're right. This, famously, senator from New York said that we're all entitled to our own opinion, but not to our own facts. That's no longer true.
So great talking to you, Ted. I really appreciate the conversation.
Likewise.
Thanks, my friend. By the way, I do want to let you share my mission. It's simple, really. I want to de-silo the world, like I was just talking about with Ted. And we've got to stop living in these little tiny boxes. Truths don't live in boxes, right? The truth doesn't live in a box. The truth is everywhere. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'll be looking for you again right here, where I hope to provide a direct impact.